Turn to Genesis chapter 37 is where we are today. As you can probably tell from the screen behind me, we are beginning a brand new sermon series here today. It's called Defying the Odds. And this is a sermon series where for the next several weeks, we're going to be taking a look at one of the more, I think, incredible figures in our Bible. And that's because we're going to take a look at the figure of Joseph. And if you don't know anything about Joseph, apart from the fact that he had a technicolor dream coat, maybe we'll actually deal with that in a little bit, then don't worry about that. We're going to introduce Joseph to you in the series. And for the next 4 weeks, we're going to kind of touch down in four different points in his life and see all that we can learn from him. And I'm excited for all that we're going to learn here today. But before we dive into our passage here today, you know, we don't talk much about individual message titles here at Friends Church, and that's honestly because I'm not all that good at them. But if I had a title for today's message, I think I would title it something like Finding God in the Dark. Or maybe Discovering God in the Midst of Disappointments. Or maybe even simply Living by faith and not by sight. Finding God in the dark, discovering God in the midst of disappointments, living by faith, not by sight. You can take whatever title you like best, but obviously from them, you get a sense of what it is that we are talking about here today. You know, one of the privileges that I get as a pastor of men and women, and it is a true privilege, is I get the opportunity to meet with a fair number of you and hear what you're going through and pray for you. And it's just been my observation, especially in the people that I've heard from and prayed for recently, it seems to me like a lot of people right now are just going through more than their fair share of difficulties. A couple weeks ago, for example, out of the message that I talked about how the Christian life is a marathon, I got an email from a man at our church, and he unfolded for me kind of all he's been through, honestly, over the last 20 years. And my jaw was dropping as I was reading this email because he has been through a lot, and he continues to be going through a lot. And I know he's not alone in that. A couple of weeks ago, for example, I got a text message from a dear friend of mine in this church who just found out his wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And actually, earlier today, he just lost his sister. And so they are navigating through all of that. After the 9 a.m. service last week, and as another example, I prayed with a young woman who broke down in tears in front of me because of some challenges that she is going through with her family. Her parents are divorced, and there's some financial difficulties right now. And it just seems that things are tough. And then on top of that, I know that there are people in this church who have recently lost their jobs. I know of one person who had a radical change in their job and a beloved boss was replaced by just a nightmare of a boss and work has become miserable. I know of a young man who just found out that he didn't get into the college of his dreams and he is devastated. And I know of a couple that just went through just a heartbreaking miscarriage. And I could go on, but you get the point. In fact, I would imagine there's not an individual among us who is either not in right now or who doesn't know someone who is in some season of hardship. And the reason for that is because, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, right, life is not without its challenges, even for us as God's people. Life is not without its difficulties. But as I have reflected on the difficulties of life, and I think I've shared with you the last couple of years have been some of the most difficult years of my own life, you know what I've discovered I think is the hardest thing about the tough seasons of life? I think one of the hardest things about the tough seasons of life is how difficult it is sometimes to see God in them, and how difficult it is to know what God is up to. This past week, I was thinking to one of my favorite books by one of my favorite authors. It's called A Grief Observed. It's by C.S. Lewis. And this is a really interesting book that he wrote. He wrote it actually after his wife of only 4 years, but really the love of his life. She passed away of cancer. And this was originally actually just his journal where he shared some of his thoughts and wrestlings with God as he dealt with the loss of his wife. And I want to read a part of this book to you because it speaks so well to what we're talking about today. We'll have the words on the screen. Lewis wrote this. He said, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcome with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is in vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away." And it's a very vivid image that he pictures here, but I just want to let you know and remind you that C.S. Lewis was not some cynic in his relationship with God. He was about as strong a believer in Jesus as you can get. And yet, I think he expresses so well in that statement what so many Christians wrestle with. In fact, I would say of the questions I get asked from people who are going through difficult times, probably the two questions that I get asked the most are, where is God and what is he doing? Pastor Chris, people will say, where is God and what I'm going through and what in the world is he up to? Well, I want to let you know, if you have ever wrestled with those questions before, or if you are wrestling with those questions right now, I just want to humbly submit to you that I believe that today's message is for you. And it is my prayer that through the passage we're taking a look at today, that you will find some hope and you will find some encouragement and you will find some resolution to your wrestling. And that's what brings us to the passage we're looking at today. As we begin this sermon series, Defying the Odds, I want to let you know we are going way back in our Bibles, okay? We're going back to a time in our Bibles that is actually known as the time of the patriarchs. It's when the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, God's people in the Old Testament, they're just in their infancy. And it's when the fathers of our faith, people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, some of them are still around and they are still walking this earth. And yet, despite the fact that the events that we're going to look at today, despite the fact that they occurred 3,800 years ago, 1,800 years, even before the time of Jesus, just so you know, the things that people went through back then aren't all that different from the things that we go through today. And that includes an experience of difficulties and hardships. And that is definitely the case with the person that we're going to be spending the next 4 weeks focusing on, and that's Joseph. In fact, as we'll see throughout this series, Joseph had more than his fair share, far more than his fair share of tough times. And you want to know the saddest thing about Joseph's tough times? It's that none of them were his fault. You see, to begin with, among other things, Joseph, he was raised in the very definition of a dysfunctional family. Just so you know, dysfunctional families were not just something that began to appear 60 years ago, okay? There have always been dysfunctional families, and the Bible is full of them. And Joseph was raised in one of the most notorious ones. In fact, to give you a sense of Joseph's family, Joseph was the second youngest of at least 14 sons and daughters in his family, born to four different women and one father. Think about that just for a second, okay? At least 14 sons and daughters born to four different women and one dad. And that tells you something about Joseph's father, Jacob. In fact, he was the Nick Cannon of his day, if any of you know who that is. And indeed, someday we should do a sermon series on him, on Jacob, not on Nick Cannon, because he is one of the more interesting characters that we have in our Bible. But Joseph, he had at least 13 brothers and sisters by his father, Jacob. But of these 13 brothers and sisters, Joseph was by far the favorite of his fathers. And Jacob was not shy about that. He let that known. Pick it up with me in verse 3 of Genesis 37. You'll see what I mean. It says this. It says, now Israel, and by the way, Israel is just another name for Jacob. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. Stop right there. And there you see it point blank, right? It says Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. And rather than hide that fact, rather than try to keep those feelings to himself, as I think any self-aware father would want to do, what does Jacob do? He does exactly the opposite. He broadcasts that to everybody. And that's what leads Jacob to give Joseph what is probably the most famous part of this Joseph story, and that is this fancy robe. As I talked about at the beginning, many of you probably know it as the amazing Technicolor dream coat. In fact, time out just for a second, my claim to fame, I don't know if you know this, but did you know I was actually in a production of Joseph and the amazing Technicolor dream coat? I was. My sixth grade class in elementary school put on a production of Joseph. And if you're wondering, no, I was not Joseph. And one of the reasons for that is because we're told a little bit later on in the book of Genesis that Joseph had an athletic build. And if you remember a couple of weeks ago, I talked about how I was a chubby kid. So in light of that, do you know what character I got in this play? I got one of the despised, rejected brothers. So that does a lot for your self-esteem, let me tell you. But I remember back to this production, and one of the things that I remember is I remember this gaudy, ostentatious coat that they gave to the guy who played Joseph, and it was filled with all these different colors. And as I said, that is probably the most remembered part of this story. Well, believe it or not, brothers and sisters, there's actually a really strong case that this coat that Joseph wore, it probably was not a multicolored coat at all. You see, the idea that this coat that Jacob gave to Joseph was multicolored, it's actually based on an old misunderstanding and an old mistranslation of the Hebrew word that is used here. The Hebrew word that is used in verse 3 to describe Joseph's coat is the Hebrew word pasim. And most scholars today believe that that word does not mean many colors or multicolored. Instead, it means something like fancy or ornate. That's how my Bible translates it. Or it even may mean something like long-sleeved, as though this was a long flowing robe, something like that. So it probably wasn't filled with many colors, but nevertheless, it was fancy. And most importantly, Joseph was the only one to be given by his father such a fancy coat. And that's terrible, isn't it? Because can you imagine what it would be like to be one of Joseph's brothers? And by the way, Joseph had 12 brothers. Can you imagine what it was like to be one of Joseph's 12 brothers and see how obviously favored by your father your brother is? And can you imagine the impact that that would have being one of the other brothers? Well, guess what? We don't have to imagine it. We're told the impact that it has. Look with me at verse 4. It says, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of him, they hated him, him meaning Joseph, and they could not speak a kind word to him. And so what was the impact of their father's favoritism? Well, it was that they hated Joseph. And that is so tragic in my opinion, because listen, whose fault was it that Joseph was the favorite one in his family? Well, it wasn't Joseph's fault. It was his dad's fault. It was Jacob's fault, right? And yet, who did the brothers direct their hatred towards? They directed their hatred towards Joseph. And isn't that such a picture of human nature? You know, I was thinking there may be some of you in this room that you still have some animosity, or maybe you even have some lingering resentment towards a brother or sister in your own life, because they seem to be your mom and dad's favorite growing up, and they got the most perks, and they got the most attention. But was that really your brother or sister's fault? Some of you are thinking, yes, it was their fault. But I would argue it wasn't their fault. Isn't it really the fault of your mom or dad for not being able to show equal love and attention and affection to all their children? You see, I really believe that if the brothers were going to be mad at anybody in this story, they should have been mad at their dad. They should have been mad at Jacob. But that's often the case with anger, right? It's not always rational. Well, that's what makes the next scene in this story turn out the way that it does. Because you see, as we continue on in Genesis 37, we find out that Joseph one day has two dreams that he shares with his family. And this is probably the other more famous part of the Joseph story. And both of these dreams involve a vision that Joseph is given. The first dream is found for us in starting in verse 5. Look at me there. It says, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. And so there we foresee the first dream. And what Joseph sees here is he sees several sheaves, bundles of grain. And these bundles of grain obviously represent his brothers. And he sees these bundles of grain bowing down to another bundle of grain, which obviously represents Joseph. And so that's the first dream that he has. And then he's given another dream, and it's very similar to the first. It just replaces the bundles of grain with the sun and the moon and the stars. And you see that in verse 9. It says, then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. And that's very similar to the first, right? And it's clear how Joseph interprets this dream. I don't think there's any other way you can interpret. He believes that the dream is a prophecy of the fact that one day Joseph's brothers, and maybe even Joseph's dad and mom, that's probably what the sun and the moon represent, that one day his family will bow down in an act of deference, maybe even in an act of servitude towards Joseph. And so Joseph has these dreams, and what does Joseph decide to do with these dreams? Well, he decides to share it with his brothers. And what a dumb move that was, right? What an absolutely moronic move that was. Listen, Joseph sharing these dreams with his brothers, that would have been bad enough in a functional family, right? That would have been hard to stomach in a healthy family. But for Joseph to share these dreams with a dysfunctional family with intense sibling rivalry, well, you can imagine the impact that this would have on Joseph's brothers. Now, just so you know, men and women, I am actually not going to get into today whether or not I believe Joseph was making a mistake truly by sharing these dreams with his family members. Just so you know, this is actually a very debated topic among Bible scholars. These are sorts of things that rile Bible scholars up. And there are some Bible scholars who believe that maybe Joseph struggled with pride and arrogance, and that's being reflected in this story, and that's why he shared these dreams with his brothers. There are other Bible scholars, however, who don't see any evidence of that in the passage, and they think that Joseph was completely innocent in sharing these dreams. He had received a vision maybe by God. He thought it was his responsibility to share this vision, and so there was no pride or arrogance involved. Now, I have a view on this, but the reason I'm not going to share that view is because at the end of the day, I don't think it matters. Because whether or not Joseph struggled with arrogance, whether or not he should or shouldn't have shared these dreams with his brothers, he did not deserve what happened next. You see, shortly after Joseph shares these dreams, we're told that one day Joseph goes to work with his brothers who are working out in a field. And by this point, Joseph's brothers, they have had absolutely enough. The coat, the favoritism, the dreams, it just has sent them over the edge. And so when they see their brother Joseph approach him, this is what the brothers decide to do. Pick it up in verse 18. It says, "But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. 'Here comes the dreamer,' they said to each other. 'Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns,'" that's like a well, "'and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams.'" And that last line is a little chilling, isn't it? "Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." It almost sounds like something out of a horror movie. And there you see just how deep this conflict between Joseph and his brothers have become. I mean, Joseph's brothers are considering doing the unthinkable. They're considering killing their own flesh and blood. Now, fortunately, before they can carry through with this plan, another opportunity presents itself. Jump down to verse 23. It says, "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, 'What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood.'" His brothers agreed. And how kind of the brothers, right? "Let's not kill our brother, let's just sell him into slavery." They're about ready to win Brothers of the Year award. Verse 28. "So when the Midianite merchants came by, the brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt." And so what we see is we see that Joseph doesn't end up getting killed. He ends up getting sold into slavery for what amounts to about $200 today, which is not even enough money to buy an iPhone, right? But that's how Joseph's brothers decide to deal with this dreamer. But obviously that's not the end of the story, because we have the problem of Jacob, right? How in the world are Joseph's brothers going to explain to their father that his favorite son is dead? Well, this is what they decide to do. Look with me at verse 31. It says, "They got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood." Hold on to that image. We'll come back to that later. Verse 32, "They took the ornate robe and back to their father and said, 'We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe.' Jacob recognized it and said, 'It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces.'" Verse 34, "Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned his son for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. 'No,' he said, 'I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave.' So his father wept for him." And how absolutely twisted of Joseph's brothers, right? I mean, to not only convince their father that his favorite son is dead, but then when they see that his father is inconsolable, what do? They have the audacity to try and comfort him, all the while knowing they could remove their father's grief in an instant if they simply told him the truth. I mean, this is borderline psychopath territory, isn't it? It's obviously that the brothers have a lot to learn to willingly watch their father suffer like that. I mean, that's terrible. But of course, Jacob is not the one who suffers the most. It's Joseph who is suffering the most. Verse 36 now. It says, "Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard." And there we see Joseph's fate. He's sold into slavery. He's taken to a foreign country. And that's sad enough. But to make a sad story even sadder, do you know how old Joseph is when all of this takes place? We find out in verse 2, he is only 17 years old. He is 17 years old, and overnight, his life becomes, I think, sort of a living nightmare. And that's why out of this story, there is a question that I have for you. And some of you can already tell what that question is. In fact, there's two questions I have for you, and that is this: brothers and sisters, where is God and what is he up to? Where is God and what is he up to? And I want to let you know that I mean that first question quite literally. Where is God in this story? You know, I observed something this past week in studying this passage I had never observed before in all my years of reading this passage. Did you know that not once in Genesis 37, not once in this scene in Joseph's life, did you know that not once is God mentioned? Did you know that not once will you see the name God or Lord or anything like that? You can test me on that. God is not mentioned at all in this story. He is not even hinted at in this story. And I think that's deliberate. You know, the authors of Scripture, they were very deliberate. They were deliberate with what they included. They were deliberate also with what they didn't include. And so I think Moses, who wrote the book of Genesis, I think he's trying to make a point by intentionally not mentioning God here. And going back to what we talked about at the beginning, I think it is related to what we talked about, right? How sometimes it feels like in the darkest seasons of our life, God can sometimes seem to be the most absent. It's what C.S. Lewis said, right? How sometimes it feels like when we need God the most, he's the most silent. And heaven seems to be the most shut. But here's what I want to let you know, okay? Just because we cannot see or feel or hear God in certain moments of our life, that doesn't mean that he's not there. And that doesn't mean that he's not moving. And that's what we see in the Joseph story. In fact, do me a favor, turn with me in your Bibles now to Genesis chapter 50, okay? Genesis chapter 50. We're going to jump ahead to the end of the story. Obviously, we will fill in the details over the next several weeks, but I want you to see where all this is headed. Genesis chapter 50. And as you turn there, you know, in the last verse of Genesis chapter 37, we're told that Joseph ends up in Egypt. He's taken from his birthplace, the land of Canaan, to Egypt, which is about 400 miles away. Well, Joseph ended up in Egypt, it ends up being a very good thing for a lot of people. You see, soon after Joseph gets in Egypt, we find out that there is a famine, a drought that covers the entire, not just Egypt, but the entire Middle East at this particular time. Well, through a series of events that we'll uncover over the next several weeks, Joseph is able to predict this famine before it happens, and he's actually able to be in a place where he can convince the Pharaoh in Egypt to save up food before this famine strikes. And the Pharaoh is able to save up enough food, not just for the country of Egypt, but he's able to save up enough food for all the inhabitants of all the surrounding regions so that they can make it through this very tough time. And so what that means, brothers and sisters, it's because Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery. Joseph was able to end up in a place where he could save thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. And Joseph eventually realizes that. And so one day, several years later, when he sees his brothers in Egypt, a few years after they sold him into slavery, I want you to see what Joseph says to his brothers. Genesis chapter 50, verse 20. He says this, he says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." And I want you to listen to that again. Remember, Joseph is talking to his brothers who sold him into slavery, and this is what he says. He says, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." And do you see what's going on there? Men and women, God's name may not be mentioned in Genesis 37, but does that mean that he wasn't there? No, what Genesis 50:20 tells us is that God was working in every verse, and he was working in every scene. I mean, what Genesis chapter 50:20 really tells us is he tells us that God was working even in the evil actions of Joseph's brothers to bring about an end result that is far greater than anybody could have imagined. And what I want to let you know here today is what was true for Joseph is also true for you and me. Men and women, life is tough sometimes. Life is difficult. Life is filled with unbelievable joy and good things. Absolutely it is. But life sometimes can be filled with blows and defeats and disappointments. Life is difficult sometimes. And I want you to know this, okay? The difficulties of this life are not what God intended for this life. And they're not what God intended for you and me. You know, if you've been around the church long enough, there is a phrase that you have probably heard people say before. My wife and I heard it a few times when we were battling with her cancer diagnosis. And that phrase is this: people will say, especially when people go through tough times, they'll say, well, it must have been God's will. Well, it must have been God's will that your wife got cancer. And listen, I absolutely understand what people are trying to say and affirm in that statement. But I also want to let you know that biblically and theologically, I have a really hard time saying things like sickness and disease and death and dying and betrayal and those sorts of things are God's will. And the reason why is because if you want to know what God's real will was for this world, there are two places in the Bible that you need to go to. You need to go to the very beginning, and you need to go to the very end. You need to go to Genesis 1 and 2, and you need to go to Revelation 21 and 22, because those are the only two places in the Bible where everything on this earth occurs exactly as God wants it to occur. And what do you see in those two places? Well, you don't see sickness and death and disease and dying and betrayal. No, what do you see? You see nothing but joy and love and peace and life and nothing but good things. And that is God's true will for this world. All the other stuff, all the bad stuff in between, that wasn't God's will. That was our will. That's what we brought into this world because of our sin and because of our rebellion. But it wasn't God's will, and I believe that about the story in Joseph. Listen, God was not behind the evil things that Joseph's brothers did. He did not cause their anger and jealousy. He did not cause them to sell Joseph into slavery, and he did not approve of any of those things one bit. He didn't. But here's the amazing thing about our God, okay? You know, one of my favorite parts of the Thanksgiving holiday, brothers and sisters, is not the Thanksgiving meal itself, but it's the meal that we have a couple of days after Thanksgiving. You see, my mom, she's an incredible chef, and she's the one who still makes Thanksgiving for our family. And a couple of days after Thanksgiving, what my mom does is she takes all the leftovers of the Thanksgiving meal, and she makes something incredible out of them. She takes the rolls, for example, those really good Hawaiian rolls that we have at Thanksgiving. She takes the ones that no one has eaten. And she takes over the leftover scraps of turkey and ham and stuffing and that sort of stuff. And she makes these slider-like sandwiches out of them. And then she brushes the top of these rolls with just this incredible butter mixture. I don't know what it is, but I could drink it straight, okay? It's so good. And then she puts this into the oven for a few minutes, and out comes something that is so delectable. It is so mouthwatering. I like it better even than McDonald's, okay? And I like it better than the Thanksgiving meal we had a few days earlier. And what amazes me about my mom in that is the ability that she has to take what are essentially discarded scraps and the ability that she has to make something out of them that is even better than the original. That's the skill that my mom has as a chef. Well, do you know what our God is? Our God is the master chef. And like my mom, our God has the ability to take the scraps of our lives, the parts that we would rather discard, the rejection letters and the bad bosses and the sicknesses and the hard times, and he has the ability to bring good out of them, often something even better than before. And not only does God have the ability to do that, he promises us that he will do that. Romans 8:28, we'll put it on the screen. I know you know this, but there's a reason you know it. It's because one of the greatest truths in Scripture. The Apostle Paul is writing here, and he says this. He says, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purposes." And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. And I want you to note what Paul doesn't say in that verse. He doesn't say all things are good. No, what does he say? He says, all things work for the good. And that's what God promises he will do in our lives. He will work everything for the good. And what I want to let you know is he is doing that regardless of whether we see, feel, or hear him doing that or not. You know, going back to what I talked about at the beginning, I don't know why sometimes it feels like when we need God the most, he can feel like he's the most absent. In fact, when I get to heaven, that is one of the questions I will ask God. God, why were you sometimes the quietest in the seasons where I needed to hear your voice the most? But despite that curious feature of how our God operates, I want to let you know he's always working. Even if we can't see him, even if we can't feel him, even if we can't hear him, he is always working. He is taking every piece, every scrap, every discarded leftover,
and he's transforming them into something good. And if we can hold on long enough, we will see that. We will see the good that God can bring out of even the darkest of situations. And today, I want to introduce you to someone who is a living testament to that. We have a special guest with us here this weekend. Those of you who have been around this church for a while, you will recognize her name. Her name is Annette Craig. And for those of you who haven't been around this church for a while, Annette is someone who had a, sort of an unspeakable tragedy happen in her life. But out of that, she founded an organization that has done a tremendous amount of good. And it's for that reason I want her to share a little bit here today, because she is a walking testimony to what it is that we are talking about. So friends, would you do me a favor? Would you give a very warm Friends Church welcome to Annette Craig as she takes the stage? Well, Annette, thank you so much for being with us here today. As I said, you just had a tragedy happen in your life, and there are some people here today that may know that story, but there's probably a fair number of people who don't. So can you share a little bit about what it is that happened?
So on May 25th, 2005, we lost our 14 and a half year old daughter, Amber, to suicide. It was unexpected. It came out of left field, and we were a family that was just left devastated.
And that is obviously, you know, every parent's worst nightmare. And so the question I have for you is, in that time, how was it to find God? Was it hard to find God, like we talked about? He's not always hard to find. So how did you find God in those moments?
Well, you know, I get asked that a lot. God was where he always was, seated on the throne, knowing that, like you said earlier, this was not his will. This was not his plan. And so I knew where he was. What I did have to do was I really had to wrestle him for the blessing in this. We were very fortunate. We had a church family that came and supported us immediately, and friends and family. And I've often described us as a broken vessel. We were just shattered from top to bottom. But we were being poured into exceedingly and abundantly more, that the blessings were overflowing in the midst of just the disaster that we found ourselves in. And so I knew where God was, but I did ask a lot of why.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as we've talked about, God is someone who has this ability to bring incredible good out of even the most difficult of circumstances and situations. So I know your story, but these people don't. What incredible good has God brought out of all that you went through?
Well, 3 days after Amber took her life, three friends came forward to tell us that they knew that she was thinking about this. They didn't know what to do with the information, and they really, nobody had ever talked to them about it. And so we instantly knew that no other family should be left picking up the pieces of a tragedy like this. No one else should be left to feel like Amber did, that suicide was her only option, and that no other friends should be left holding on to this information. And so I really didn't know. Fun fact, I hate to publicly speak. Never tell God what you're not going to do, because that's about what he's going to have you do all the time. And so we just wanted to make sure that this didn't happen to another family. And so what we did was we started with HOPE, the Amber Craig Memorial Foundation. And originally we thought if we could just tell, she was a freshman at El Dorado High School at the time, if we could just talk to the kids at El Dorado. But what rapidly happened was we found out this wasn't a conversation that was being had. And so we started going into schools and communities and talking with kids about recognizing the warning signs of suicide and depression and giving them an outlet to come forward. Friends who had been, you know, promised to keep this secret, we've given them permission to come forward to a trusted adult. And for the last almost 19 years, we've been working in schools and throughout communities, helping connect kids, at-risk kids, to help and having this conversation. And at the same time, as a family that found themselves just in the depths of grief, we ended up starting a bereavement support group. And so we spend about 50% of our time on the prevention side and 50% of the time on helping individuals who've lost a loved one to suicide.
So how have you seen the truth of what we've talked about here today made real in your life?
I think for starters, to say that something that was born out of a tragedy in our living room, I remember Matthew and I in my living room, broken, crying with my family, making a promise that we would work together to make sure that this didn't happen again. The fact that it's 19 years. If you had told me that 19 years later, this is where we'd stand, I would have said, absolutely not.
Yeah.
God has been faithful every step of the way, in ways that we couldn't even imagine. And it's hard to imagine that it's been 19 years.
Yeah.
But in that time, we have helped hundreds of thousands of people and been able to walk alongside of them and really see how God has led us. And it would have been easy, I guess, to sit down and say, no, I don't think so. But I kind of wrestled him for the blessing in this, and just following him in the dark, not knowing where we were going, I can look back and see how he has just blessed our socks off.
Strikes me how much of it's like the story of Joseph. It resulted in the saving of many lives, and we will have no idea how many lives have been saved as a result of this. How can we, as a church, individually, how can we support all that you guys are doing?
So we're really excited because every year we host a walk, and this is our 17th walk. We've actually added a 5K run, and we're really excited because we're going to be hosting it here at Friends. So it's nice to come back and just be able to do it here. And so there's a couple opportunities. You can register to walk or run.
And when is that walk?
Saturday, March 2nd. You can volunteer to help. We need lots of volunteers to pull this off. Or you can donate. This weekend is a matching weekend. Up to $20,000 will be matched this weekend. So if you want to walk, you can join us, or run. If you want to volunteer, that would be great. Or if you'd like to donate, that would be
fantastic.
Yeah,
just so you know, we're taking a special offering at the end of the service as you leave, and anything that you give to that offering will be given to the With Hope Foundation, and it will also be matched up to $20,000, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. Hey, Annette, thank you so much for being with us
thank
here
you.
Today. Can we thank Annette for being with us? Well, as we close here today, where does this leave all of us? What do we do out of all of this? Well, there's just a few thoughts that I want to share with you, okay? And these will be on the back screen, and I'll go through these quickly. The first thought is this, and I won't spend hardly any time on this because we've already touched upon it, but that is that to follow Jesus is to face tough times, okay? To follow Jesus is to face tough times. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The Christian life is like a marathon. And if we face difficulties, that is not a sign that we are doing anything wrong. It's just a part of what it means to be a Christian sometimes. And so we need to expect these things to happen. But at the same time, I want you to hear this, okay? Though it may feel at times like it's really difficult in these tough seasons to see, feel, or hear God, the second thing I want to let you know is this: God's silence does not signify his absence. God's silence does not signify his absence. In fact, if there is really one thing I want to get across to you here today, it is this right here. As I said, I don't know why. Sometimes it feels like when we need God the most, sometimes he seems to be the quietest. But I take comfort in the fact that I'm not the only one to observe that. And Christians throughout the years and in Scripture have observed that very same thing about God. But here's what I know, okay? Whether we hear him or see God, he is still moving. He is still working. And so we need to be people who learn to walk by faith and not by sight. And we need to be people who learn to trust in the recipe, even if we cannot see the chef who wrote it, okay? And by the way, that means also that we need to continue to pray, even if sometimes it doesn't seem like our prayers are going anywhere, because God is hearing them and he is listening to them, and they do make a difference. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is this: whatever you're going through, remember God's promise of good for you. Whatever you're going through, remember God's promise of good for you. Jeremiah 29:11, many of you know this verse. It's basically a variation of Romans 8:28. God promises this to his people. He says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." And that's a promise that God makes to us. that no matter what, he is going to turn what we're going through into good. Sometimes the good is not really seen until the next life. Most of the times, I think it is seen in this life. But no matter what, we need to hold on to that promise because God stays true to his promises. And so, yes, maybe you didn't get into the college of your dreams. And I know how disappointing that can be. But you know what? There are people in this room who will tell you that the best thing that ever happened to them is that they didn't get into the college of their dreams. Because it led them to where they are today, and they would not trade where they are today for the world. So that doesn't mean that you can't be disappointed. But what I am trying to say is that God knows what he's doing. He is committed to your good, and he will see that through. And that goes for all of us. A bad boss, maybe God trying to get you out of your current job and career into something that even better that he has for you. A surprise medical diagnosis, maybe God using that to bring your family closer together. Even an unspeakable tragedy, maybe God using you to speak hope into the lives of others. As we saw, that's some of what God did with Annette's story. But like a great chef, God doesn't waste anything. And he won't waste what you're going through. So take courage. God is with you, and he will see you through this.